Welcome to Real Asian Podcast. I am Raymond Liu, and I'm joined today with Pragya and Baldwin. What's up, y'all?
What up, rep heads?
What's up, everybody?
All right, today we are going to talk about our top five favorite API directors, something that I'm really excited about. There's so many great filmmakers out there, not even just within the API space, but specifically within the API space, there's so many visionary and up-and-coming directors. I really wanted to give this opportunity to really talk about filmmakers who've been doing it for a long time and also filmmakers who, you know, I think we think that everyone should look out for, right? So I wanted to start by asking both of you guys, when it comes to the word director or a film director, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
I mean, for me, it's like a person sitting on one of those little chairs, right? With like
the director chair.
The director chair.
Yeah.
With their name on it.
Mm-hmm, with their name on it. And then they have like, I forgot what these things are called, but it does the sound thing. And they're like, you know.
Oh, the clapper.
Yeah, the clapper. Yeah. So that's what comes to mind. But, you know, as far as directors go, I tend to think of them as people who like really leave their mark on a film. So like usually like between directors, there's a lot more continuity in terms of like the tone and the story of a film than, you know, any other sort of aspect of the film.
Yeah, I would agree. When I think of director, I think of someone who's crafting a film in their vision. So they have like full creative control throughout the entire process, and they're in charge of the entire process. So they have to manage all facets of the film, from who's in charge of the like set design, the sound mixing, camera angles, obviously, and especially the actors, just like managing the actors themselves, in order to bring all that together to make sure everything is captured in the way that they want to, in order to like manifest their vision of the film. So when I think of a director, I pretty much see them as having ownership of the film for the most part. And I think that they get the most credit for the final product because they have the most control. That isn't the case for all films. Obviously, sometimes it's driven by the cast or producers, but for the most part, I think it's the director.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about directors, yeah, definitely a lot of it, what you guys already said, someone who's in charge, a visionary, even if they're like a, even if they're not so much a household name, when I'm like, I'm imagining on set, they're just someone who's very distinct and specific in what they want to make. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've watched a lot of actor interviews, and you often find that when they really enjoy working with a particular type of director, they often say, like, you know, someone who's just very collaborative, but very direct, director, you know, but, you know, assertive. They're not someone who's not going to know what's going on. They always have an answer. They're always able to kind of adjust and really put their vision on screen. And that's someone I think a lot of us probably have, the directors on our list probably have those qualities in some form of fashion, either exceed in multiple ways, but also in their own unique ways. So what we'll do in this episode is, as we've done in other countdown episodes, if you will, we'll start with our criteria before we get into our list, talk about what make the qualities of the directors on our list, why they made the cut of our criteria, and then we'll go start at number five all the way up to number one. We'll go ahead and do opposite of snake draft. I actually don't know the term of not snake draft. Like round robin. Is it round robin? So I'll go ahead and start, and then we'll go Baldwin and then Pragya at number five, and then back to me, and then we'll go from there. Sound good?
Yep, let's do it.
Before we get into my number five, my criteria. So the directors on my list are directors whose films I will always watch, regardless of the audience or critical reception it gets. These are filmmakers who I feel have their own distinct style and dare to tell a unique story. The majority of my list have a bright future, and I really do think these directors are going to continue standing out from the crowd and, you know, not only proudly represent their culture, but also normalize the fact that a person of color could be a big shot director in the film industry. So that is, you know, really kind of what encapsulates my list. Certain qualities about them are unique and something that I just really gravitate towards. So going into my number five, I have Justin Chan as my number five. Pragya, I believe you have Justin Chan on your list as well, correct?
I do.
So I think Justin distinguishes himself as someone who isn't afraid to be bold. You know, Justin has the tendency to tell stories that aren't often told. He can kind of he likes to kind of go where not a lot of filmmakers will want to go, tend to push the boundaries a little bit. I think so, at least in some of the films that he's made so far. Obviously, he started off of being in front of the camera. The big first big film of his is being playing Eric Yorkie in Twilight. Since then, he's kind of gravitated more into filmmaking, writing and directing Gook in 2017, Miss Purple in 2019, and most recently Blue Bayou in 2021, which we did an episode on. Go check it out now. And then I believe he's also directed a few episodes on the Apple TV Plus show Pachinko. Have not seen it yet, but everyone keeps telling me to go watch it. I will say this, though. I think what Justin Chan intriguing to me is that he can be really polarizing. He seems to be the type of filmmakers that makes the films that he wants to make, not necessarily what the industry is trending towards, right? So you think about the movies like Miss Purple. It's a film about abandonment and family dysfunction. Gook, racial tensions between Korean Americans and Black Americans during the LA riots in the 90s. Blue Bayou, Korean American adoptee experience and like the pitfalls of the adoption system in the U.S. You know, these aren't topics we typically see in movies. And as with any great filmmakers, it can go right up to the line for some folks to the point where they even want to criticize him. But I think all of that, one of the great things about Justin is that he's like a true story in his own right. And I think that's why he deserves the number five spot in my list.
I mean, wow, that was a lot. Did you pre-write all of this? Super ready to like
ready to go
indeed. Yeah, I mean, he's on my list, so I will get to what I like about him when I get there. But I definitely like what you said about how he pushes the envelope and makes the films that he wants to make as opposed to the ones that people think they want to see. I think that's very important.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Baldwin, you're number five.
All right, so I guess we're going to go over our criteria first. So first off, I obviously have to have seen their movies, of course. But the main criteria for me is really the body of work, meaning the amount of great movies the director has made and has success on over the course of their career. And drilling down deeper, when I'm ranking my favorite Asian directors and my own personal taste, I'm really looking for rewatchability. So movies that are hard to forget and they stay with you, they're worth talking about and watching, and it's movies that I talk to my friends about, basically. So with all of these directors, if they have a new film coming out, I'm definitely watching it. Like, it's a done deal. And I think overall, they're extremely, like I said, watchable. So their movies have really compelling stories and are highly thematic, almost to the point of being campy or cultish. And by this, I mean it's extremely stylistic, and it's all in on that style. Whether it be the theme, the set designs, or the period, or its message, I think that when you can clearly like extract some of the main ideas from a movie, it's a hallmark of a great director.
You love that style.
Yeah, exactly.
The style directors.
Exactly. And I feel like in many cases, I tend to gravitate more towards films that have strong visual motifs, which is like a form of poetry that's unique to film. So I think the more densely a film can pack itself with more like focus, skill, and subtext, the closer it gets to five stars for me. So that's the criteria I'm basing my favoritism on. But to start with number five is Bong Joon-ho, director of Parasite. I think he's a master of his craft. And the reason why is Joon-ho uses basically every tool he has to reinforce his overall message throughout the film, from like the use of lighting and framing to, you know, hair design or makeup and wardrobe, and especially the dialogue in a movie. He's obviously very well recognized as a filmmaker. He won several Oscars for Parasite, but some of his other movies like Okja, Mother, The Host, Snowpiercer was super dope, and also Memories of Murder. They're all amazing films to watch, and he doesn't just direct the movies, he also writes pretty much all of them too. So that's what I mean when I say he's holistically a master filmmaker. You know, going on, I think his ability to use visual language rather than spoken language to communicate his themes and his story is very impressive. He uses different filmmaking techniques like the framing, the dialogue, colors, all to reinforce that message, like I said. And he's not afraid to critique society either, and the traditions. And he's not afraid to like use his films as a medium or a vehicle for social commentary. So he does all this while also creating extremely watchable and thrilling films, just creating tension and anticipation very well, and setting up his climatic moments so well too. It's like you could see it from all of his movies. So that's why he's number five for me on my list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's really critical of Hollywood. Every time I think of him, I think of what Praga has mentioned before, is that he calls the Oscars a local award local, show. Yeah.
But he's not just critical of Hollywood. He's sort of a anarchist in his politics as far as, and you can see it in the films. You don't have to like wonder where he stands on a lot of things. And so even with Parasite getting all of the applause and recognition it did, there was a lot of people who had to sort of look away from what the point of that film was, right?
For sure.
So I think that he just finds it amusing that he's got this like large amount of success where the films that he's making are so counter to the value system within which he finds his success. So,
So true. Yeah. So are you saying he's the ultimate troll?
Definitely. You can totally actually, people should do this. Go look up Bong Joon-ho just trolling, because there's so many different
savage
interviews and like just moments where he's being a troll.
Okay, Praga. Yeah. Okay. Criteria and number five.
Yeah, so my criteria is that I'm not easily impressed. So if I watched a film by any of these directors and felt like, wow, I feel like I just experienced something impressive, they kind of make it onto my list.
You hear that, guys? Praga is not easily impressed. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Nice way to lead it.
Yes. Sorry. Well, Raymond has planned a lot of his jokes for this one. So
this don't one give away my secret, okay?
It's, okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
Right. But the point is that whether it's something that they did with a narrative, whether it's the way that they infuse the film with philosophy or meaning, or the way that they're able to have like a reflection on historical moments, I tend to choose my favorite directors based on a sort of like cleverness that they bring to the films that they're doing. So it can be different cleverness. I know Baldwin said that you like visual specific kind of like techniques and such. For me, it can be visual techniques, it can be narrative techniques, it could just be like the overall storytelling. So to get into my fifth one, which is cool because it piggybacks off of Bong Joon-ho, is Park Chan-wook, who is a Korean director. Some of his most famous films, he produced Snowpiercer, so I think he was credited on that. But some of his most famous films are The Handmaiden, I think Old Boy, Lady Vengeance. And one of my favorites, which is lesser known, is JSA, the Joint Security Area. And so you will see, I think, if any listeners or you guys decide to watch his films, that they keep a similar thematic to Bong Joon-ho, which is a lot of reflection on Korean society. And his visual style is much more, I would say, elegant and like feeling than Joon-ho's can be sometimes, because he can be a little bit can be a little bit direct or straightforward. But there's also sort of like a gore aspect to a lot of Chan-wook's films. So I personally can't watch all of them all the time because I'm like, oh, I can't handle this. But out of South Korea, I think he's like one of the big director or directorial names to watch. And so, he's number five on my list. I really like JSA, by the way, is a film about North and South Korea. And I won't spoil anything, but it really gives you like a nuanced like Korean viewpoint of that conflict. And so mm-hmm. it's a very interesting film to watch, you know, from the outside.
I've seen the old or the American version of Old Boy, mm-hmm. But not the Korean version yet. I heard it's like even more kind of fucked up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you mentioned Memories of a Murder. So
I'm just looking at like all the movie posters of the movies he's done. Very mm-hmm. dark. It's like mm-hmm. kind of eerie a little bit. So mm-hmm.
it's very. Yeah, there's a darkness to it.
There's a darkness.
Darkness. Okay. Okay. I'll go into my number four. So my number four favorite director is Alice Wu. Got to give props to Alice Wu. Mm. Fellow South Bay native. I've mentioned many times on this pod how Saving Face is one of my favorite movies of all time. And what I love most about Alice Wu is her undeniable talent. You know, she was working at a typical desk job at Microsoft and had the creative bug within her. And she always tells a story about how she worked on her script on the script of Saving Face while she was working at Microsoft at her desk, typing it up when she should have been working. But I mean, I do that too. and during this time, you know, she ultimately was able to get her movie made. And her follow-up film, the half of it, was equally as charming and heartfelt. I just find her style and vision super captivating and relatable. You know, the way that she does rom-coms is so rooted in deep human in the deep human experience, rather than kind of, you know, relying on the typical tropes to comfort audiences, because sometimes that's right. what we seek in rom-coms. But you know, no, she wants us to think, she wants us to feel, she wants us to empathize with the characters on screen. I do acknowledge that Alice as a whole hasn't made too many feature films yet, but I think she's definitely one of those directors who has a loyal following and has critics who I think are waiting to see what her next project is. And I'm sure she's working on something as we speak right now. And, you know, I just can't wait for it. So Alice Wu definitely sits at number four on my list. San Jose.
Yeah, it's, you know, with the movie, the half of it, like my wife was watching it and I wasn't really watching it with her, but like, you know how somebody's watching something and you just tune in, and then I just ended up like watching the whole movie with her because I thought it was so interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a quality in a movie when you can kind of just jump into it and you're like, oh, you know, I'm kind of sucked in. Mm-hmm. Number four.
All right, number four for me is Ang Lee, the famed director. So he's, when I think of Ang Lee, he's like the manifestation of East meets West and like the effects of globalization on the world, because he was born in Taiwan, but he spent most of his adult life in the U.S. So I think his story is kind of relatable to a lot of Asian Americans in terms of feeling like an outsider to both cultures. And it's amazing how he's able to go back and forth between the two countries and the two audiences in his movies, like Chinese movie, and then he goes to an American movie and he goes back and forth. It's just really, really impressive. And he's directed some amazing films. A lot of them aren't even Asian stories either. Like I said, some of them, like some of the bigger ones are Sense and Sensibility, Ride with the Devil, The Hulk, Brokeback Mountain, Life of Pi, Lost Caution, and then of course, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So he has a lot of range and his body of work really speaks for itself. He won the best director two times for Brokeback Mountain and Life of Pi. So in terms of like what I really like about his style specifically, he's able to bring out really intimate relationships in his movies, and he's able to like flesh out those relationships between characters and also their like deep-seated psychological barriers, and uses that as the motivations to their actions. And he uses this as a core element in many of his movies. Like if you've seen Brokeback Mountain, it's like the struggle of being a closeted gay person in that environment, you know, the cowboy environment. And with The Hulk, he really explored it wasn't just an action movie. He explored Bruce Banner's relationship with his father. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, because of his history, he's also able to explore the relationship between society and the individual and what it means to be an outsider too. And all of his movies have like really, really mature themes, which, you know, a lot of movies these days, they can be really like poppy, like whatever's like interesting at the moment, right? It's not really full of depth. So I think that Ang Lee's ability to explore the human condition and have diversity in his subject matters while also making like really emotional films successfully, is that's why he's one of my favorite directors.
Mm-hmm.
He's made like all types of movies. That's mm-hmm. rare for someone like that, because typically, you know, you get pigeonholed, you know, mm-hmm. even directors get pigeonholed, but he's been able to make a whole bunch. I know, I think I heard that he was supposed to direct the Mulan remake. He didn't, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder what that would have, how that would have turned out.
I wish he did, yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been so much better.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see.
That would have had a completely different, like, visual language to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did really like Lust Caution, but, you know, as you say, like, those, like, intricate, deep relationships and the psychology, I wouldn't, like, put it as, like, my favorite film or a film I'd watch again.
Very explicit film.
Yeah, that, and, like, you know, it was, I wouldn't call it dark. It was just difficult times and, like, tragedy and all of that, so.
Kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. He does a good job of like diving into those kinds of things. So that was, yeah, that's a good one. So is it my turn?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Okay. So my number four was Ray's number five, and this is Justin Chan.
Hey.
And I think we heard me sort of like waxing lyrical about him on the Blue Bayou episode. And Ray has mm-hmm. done a great job of introducing the director himself. So I'll just say that I really appreciate when someone is willing to articulate things that are unsaid or things that mm-hmm. go in between spaces. And I think he does a really good job of doing that and then making films about those very specific things. And I think, you know, like you said, that's why a lot of people feel seen, but a lot of people also want to like clamp down on it. They're like, you're saying something that, you know, maybe nobody's comfortable saying. So
yeah. And that's often what happens with someone kind of going a little beyond the mm-hmm. lines that people set. It's like, wait a minute, are you supposed to do that?
I know.
You know?
And also I think there's a piece of like, why can you do it and I couldn't do it? And like the I couldn't do it aspect of it was self-enforced, right? So
yeah.
So he's got like that bravery to go into those like nitty-gritties.
There's this story that he tells about him walking out of an audition early on in his career for a role that was borderline racist. I guess mm-hmm. I think the role had him having to do like a Chinese accent, but it was like an irrelevant accent. It was just mm-hmm. for comedic effect.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, he realized that most likely the movie will be made anyways, and the role will go to some other Asian actor who really needs the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, though, and that just basically explains how it was slim pickings back then, right? But after that experience, that's when he decided, I think he said that the best way to change the landscape of opportunity for Asian Americans or just POCs in general is to create.
Mm-hmm.
Create movies for mm-hmm. himself, create movies that so he can create roles that are not reductive, not racist, not disparaging,
mm-hmm.
so that actors don't have to sell their souls for the work. And to me, I think that's another reason why Justin Chan is one of my favorite directors.
Mm.
Definitely get behind that. That is awesome. And yeah, that's also why he makes my list, because like I said, I'm not easily impressed, but I'm impressed.
Oh, hopefully he hears that. Justin Chan probably is impressed by it.
Yeah.
You got to include that sound bite.
Just in case he's interested. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. You're like, I'm impressed.
I'm impressed.
Okay. My number three is Anish Jaganti. So another South Bay native. Anish is also from San Jose, or I think he worked in San Jose. Or no.
Is it Fremont?
Fremont. Something like,
I mean, if he's Indian, it's got to be Fremont.
Somewhere in the South Bay, East Bay-ish area. I think Anish has a lot of potential of being a household name in the horror suspense genre. His debut film, Searching, with John Cho was absolutely phenomenal. It was gripping, compelling, and completely suspenseful, all done through the webcam view, right? The whole technology gimmick thing with horror films, which kind of started with, I think the movie was called Friended, and it came out in the early 2010s. You know, the problem with those films, I always thought, and me and Alan talked about it in the Searching episode, is that it's super gimmicky, right? It's hard for you to kind of buy into the story, and that's the reason why I think the best horror movies are because the story is you know, gripping. So it's really hard to buy into it if the story is kind of whack. But Anish did it the right way by doing all this world building and searching and writing a terrific story. And, you know, the core question of the movie, if you haven't seen it, is basically what are the lengths a parent would go for their child? And his follow-up film, Run, with Sarah Paulson, which I think is on Hulu, kind of plays on that same sense of parental protection, but adds on to it what happens if it goes too far, right? And I have to imagine, you know, Anish being of Asian descent, kind of underneath that whole parental, you know, overbearing and stuff like that. I think he just took that. He's like, what if I just made it into a movie, you know? And he asks like questions like, what happens when the parent is more of the problem than the solution? So I think Anish Chaganti has a real distinct style of portraying these real life and relevant questions, but in a psychological, thrilling fashion. You know, one of the reasons why Jordan Peele is lauded as a great director in horror is mainly because it's smart, right? It's philosophical. It has many mm-hmm. layers to it. I think Anish is kind of trending towards that same path. And so I anticipate him gaining a lot of worldwide attention in the coming years. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I actually don't know this one. Shame on me. So I'll have to look all of this up after. But he sounds awesome.
I was really impressed with searching.
Yeah, not that long of a resume yet. Mm-hmm. I'm going off of just heat check rules. Like the first two films that he's made is pretty solid. And I think he's filming Searching 2 right now as we speak. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see how that turns out. With any sequel, I'm always like, okay, here we go. Mm-hmm,
She goes missing again?
Yeah, I guess. Searching again. Yeah, oh I guess God. So.
Just kidding.
I don't know. Okay.
Totally.
Okay, Baldwin, number three.
All right, my number three. So I got to say also, before I say my number three, it's not ranked in order. It's really hard to rank these directors, but my number three is Wong Kar-wai, and you know he needs no introduction. We have an episode coming out on him.
Sounds like Wong Kar-wai is number three for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Wong Kar-wai number three. His movies are just like I feel like they're more abstract and philosophical in a sense. Like he's trying to express his feelings about love and time and relationships and Hong Kong culture all through his movies. And he uses like very, very distinct visual and narrative styles too. Like visually, it's very moody and vibey. It's like sultry, right? It's mm-hmm. all of his movies always make me feel some type of way. And then his narrative style too is very unconventional because it's usually not linear in storytelling. It's very fragmented and even like chaotic at times too. And I think he purposefully does this to express his idea of those themes that we talked about, like love and time and memories. But for me, I think his biggest strength is his ability to show the human experience very well. A lot of his movies revolve around the theme of loneliness and isolation and longing. And I felt that with his characters very powerfully. And also his ability to create intimacy between characters, something I think a lot of directors struggle with. Because it's very difficult to do to create that chemistry between characters.
Yeah.
But the dialogue and direction that he provides, like the body language, the camera effects, and all the stylistic elements, it all provides like layers of intimacy and connection between his characters. Mm-hmm. So I really can't wait to see what he does next because I'd definitely be there to watch it.
So by the time this episode comes out, we've already released the Wong Kar-wai Cinematic Universe episode. So
yes.
If you haven't listened to that, go check that out now. We go deep dive into all his films, Wong mm-hmm. Kar-wai.
Yeah, he's an important one. He's an important director.
Perhaps the most distinct thing about Wong Kar-wai is sunglasses.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
I don't think I've ever seen his eyes.
He has to. It's like Cyclops, you know, like he has to, or like if he takes them off, he'll start like shooting laser beams.
Yeah, I know, right?
He loses the allure.
Yeah.
It could be the next phase of his filmmaking, though. It's right? Like, oh shit, the sunglasses are coming off.
He's digivolved.
Okay, Frog, yeah.
Okay, go so for it. My third director is Satoshi Kon. who is a Japanese animation director, or was. He is deceased. Rest in peace. He's most famous for Perfect Blue, Tokyo Godfathers, and Paprika. And he, the stories I would say that he works on, they don't appeal to me as much as his cinematography and his transitions and his visual style. And anytime you watch a Satoshi Kon work, like, you know immediately, like, you're watching Satoshi Kon. And I would say the appeal is that the way that he designs his work, it puts you in like a liminal space between fantasy and sort of reality, and, well, you know, as real as you can get in animation. And it really is like fast paced and sucks you in, because you have to pay attention to what's happening. Things are changing so fast. The pace of all of the animation is so quick, and like the imagery and visual sort of like foreshadowing is so clever. That he's definitely one to check out if you're a film buff of any sort.
Yeah, he passed away so young, 46.
Mm-hmm, very
unfortunate.
Young.
Really?
Yeah.
He
made a lot of films.
I mean, if you think about the rate, it's like impressive.
Well, he was definitely a workaholic. So I believe he died of illness, but I think he was very committed to his craft and just wanted to make as many films as possible. He definitely did. Yeah.
Interesting. I've never heard of him, but I definitely want to watch his films now based on how you're describing him.
Well, so that's why I linked in my notes the trailer for Paprika, because I was hoping that someone might click on it and see it.
I saw it. I clicked on it.
But you should watch the Japanese one. I linked the English one. That one's more impressive.
So would you say Inception bit off of Paprika? Oh,
for sure. Inception, Black Swan, all of these films, like, he really pioneered that sort of style, for sure.
Gotta watch them now.
Did Christopher Nolan say that he was inspired by, or say anything?
I'm sure. I mean, we'll have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure everyone else was able to see it immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
Okay, my number two, Chloe Zhao. Oh, yeah. So Chloe Zhao, I think, is on this meteoric rise. She's made successful independent films to probably directing the biggest film that you could possibly make, which is a Marvel film. Mm-hmm. Zhao is known to be super personal when she's directing. She really dives into getting to know the actors, giving them, like, trying to understand their vision, giving them full creativity, and really connecting and collaborating with them. I think she somehow imbues the sentimentality of in all her films. And one of the things I love about Chloe Zhao's style is that she really emphasizes landscape shots and really tries to get the audience to understand the world that she's building through the visuals. In Nomadland, you know, there were these gorgeous scenic shots of the outdoors, the mountains, the desert, the environment. And if you know anything about filmmaking, especially when you're filming outdoors, there's so many variables that could go wrong because there's not much controlling that you could do as you would in a studio. But if you watch Nomadland, I mean, a lot of the time the shots, it seems like the background is the foreground and the actor is kind of just like a small piece of it. So it's not necessarily focused on Frances McDormand, the main character. But yeah, it's like so many of these cute, gorgeous shots. And I mean, to me, I think this just proves that how much of a hippie she is at heart. And then going over to Eternals, and I know The Rider is also one of her, you know, big successful films as well. And it got so much critical acclaim. But with The Eternals, you know, you think about the scale of a Marvel movie, she kind of had this unique ability to make this epic movie, but also have an intimate feeling with it, with all the Eternals and the love story between Cersei and Icarus. I know Eternals, some people didn't quite like it. Some people thought it was a little bit too slow, but I actually like the Eternals, and specifically because of Chloe Zhao's vision of it. Like, it was this huge Marvel movie, but she made it, like, she humanized it. She kind of put it in a way to where, yeah, like, these celestials and these Eternals, they're godlike, they're super, they're invincible, but they empathize with humans and they understand the flaws of humans, and it kind of puts them in this humanistic nature that we start to sort of relate with the Eternals, and that's part of the reason why I liked it. And what I love about Chloe is that she's a true student of the art form. She's a former Spike Lee student, and she's also stated how she's been very influenced by Wong Kar-wai herself. And so I think she's just truly an artist in her own right. She's boosted her reputation with this Eternals Marvel movies, and I can't wait to see what she's going to make next.
She's definitely one of the biggest up-and-coming directors of our time. I don't see what's coming up next for her, but I can't wait to see it either.
There's a multiple actors tell the story of Chloe Zhao kind of as soon as the scene is shot, she always runs up to the actors right afterwards, sprints towards them and just debriefs with the actors of the scene. How did you feel? What did you think? Do you want to do it again? Not many directors often do that. Sometimes it's great shot, print it, whatever. But she always kind of comes up to the actors and kind of understands them and gives them maybe notes, but also just kind of tries to understand their perspective. Baldwin? Your number dose? All right.
My number two, which I feel like can also be interchanged with my number one, but number two, Hayao Miyazaki.
Hey.
Of course.
Hayao is one of my favorite directors ever. Anytime he has a new movie come out, it's just must watch for me, absolutely. And you can always tell a Miyazaki film when you see it. It's that vibrant painterly style where every frame can be its own painting, and everything, even in the background, is alive. And he has an obsession with nature. So whether it be water or wind or animals, it's always a core element. And that's something I really appreciate. So, yeah, and I think the goal of animation really is to bring out this feeling of wonder and beauty. And I feel like Miyazaki is definitely a master of that, because his creations are so unique and atypical. But it's that creativity that makes their world so expansive and inviting for you to enter.
Yeah.
And for me, I have this feeling of wanting to live in that world and explore it to see what else can you find in there. And another big strength of Miyazaki that's complemented by his animation is his storytelling, how he's able to show good and evil in all aspects of life, how it's not black and white, very nuanced. And he uses those characters to drive the plot. So it's not he doesn't use external events like war or natural disaster. That doesn't cause the action, even though it might be the setting. It's the characters and their motivations, their emotional journey, and their character arc that's always at the center of his movies. The last thing I want to say about Miyazaki and why he's one of my favorite directors, and I've said this before, is just how his movies make me feel. And all the nostalgia, I'm watching this fairy tale as if I'm a kid again, without a care in the world, and just letting myself get engrossed in his world and experience something that feels like a really classic and timeless story.
Yeah, he's got a magical quality to him. So definitely see why that's up there.
I have Miyazaki is on my list as my number one, but we'll go over it when I get there. But certainly he's a true artist. It's hard to be so distinct and be so unique in the animation field, and to have so many animators often reference Miyazaki whenever they need to be inspired or they're stuck or in whenever they're influenced. Miyazaki is always comes up. He's always the one that people kind of gravitate towards. Pragya?
Okay, so for my number two-ish, I mean, we said that these weren't like in an order. So this one is like, which one is not like the others? And it's Andrew Lau, not to be confused with Andy Lau, but like, Yeah. So it's
I thought it was.
Yeah. No.
I was like, he directed too? He does everything.
I was typing fast and I was like, Andy, but no, it's Andrew Lau. But the funny thing is that he worked on Infernal Affairs. Obviously, he's the director of the 1, 2, and 3. And also Young and Dangerous 1 through 5. What is it? Like From Vegas to Macau, like 1, 2, 3. So this is a man who
loves sequels.
Yeah. But actually, there's sort of an interesting reason for this. And it's because like during a certain time, like Hong Kong was just like a filmmaking, like they were just churning them out. Like they weren't like particularly low budget or anything, but like so many films were coming out of that scene. And so he's a really prolific director. He also, by the way, has a credit on Chungking Express as a cinematographer. So that's a little fun fact.
Yeah.
But
I mean, he shot the beginning portion of it. And then Christopher Doyle took over.
Maybe. I don't know completely. Okay, good job, Raymond. I just know that there was a credit. what I wanted to say was, like, you know, like in Japan, they have manga and you have like weekly Shonen Jump and like there's just so many manga coming out, right? Yeah. This would be like your Shonen Jump of like Hong Kong directors. Like he always does like the same kind of like, you know, triad gangster, like a sort of like almost lowbrow, but not quite, kind of like fighty action film. And if you watch his work, then you'll become very familiar with like sort of like that scene. Overall, I like his work and I put him on my list because I think it takes a lot for me to be interested in like sort of like action film, but these particular films I can usually just come in wherever and start watching and I just feel like I'm having a good time. And so that's my reasoning.
What it sounds like he did, he just said, I really liked this genre. I'm just going to do everything I possibly can in this genre. And I'm just going to own this space.
He really does.
Yeah.
He knows what he's good at.
Yeah, you have the Ang Lee route where you can do all types of things. Or you can do the Andrew Lau. It's like, I'm just going to do this one thing really well.
Really, really well. And he always, you know, has like the big names like Tony Leung, Andy Lau. Like all of the people you'd recognize are in these films. There's an interesting one I'll bring up later called Sausalito, which is based in SF and it's like a little romance. So we should look at that one day.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never heard of him, but yeah, I mean, so a few of these directors, like I'm really glad I get the chance to like hear about them because yeah, they all seem like they're really amazing and movies that I definitely want to watch. So it's funny because I can't help but just be like thankful to, you know, be on the podcast and learn about all these amazing Asian American directors and take a closer look at them and examine them because it's something that I never would have done. So very cool.
And if it impressed Praga, you know that
yeah,
there's something to it probably.
Means we better pay attention. It means everyone out there needs to pay attention if Praga is impressed.
If I have something nice to say about it, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, go check it out, guys.
You should just, you're going to troll us one day and just recommend a really terrible film or director.
And we would never know.
Yeah, and we're like, she's really into this? Okay, I guess.
I was like, oh yeah, I guess that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, so like, I don't think the audience has the same background because I think we lost the Better Luck Next Time.
Sorry,
Better Luck Tomorrow. Yeah, it was Raymond and Baldwin and you guys are just
shot
like,
it down.
There's some good things about this film. And I was like, here is every way it is fucked up. And let me tell you.
One day you're going to be like, Michael Bay is an amazing director. And we're like, I guess he is. Like,
all right. I mean, I'll this is my out. Equivalent of saying Michael Bay is an amazing
director. Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Michael Bay, yeah. It's like the Asian Michael Bay.
The Asian Michael Bay, yeah.
Alrighty, now we're going into our number one. So number one, I mentioned it. I've got Hayao Miyazaki. Baldwin explained and said all the amazing points of why I love Hayao Miyazaki too. So outside from a filmmaking perspective, I think what I love about Miyazaki is how openly opinionated he is. Like, he sort of got that grumpy old man vibe about him, but it's also kind of harmless in a way, you know? No one is going to argue against Miyazaki. Like, they may not agree with him, but he's reached a level to where he's so beloved. So I was like, okay, maybe he has a point kind of thing. And he's been critical about the current state of the anime industry, saying it's too unrealistic, which is kind of funny if you think about it. But he's also criticized the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on a couple of his policy, talking about how going against constitutional reform in Japan and trying to like wipe away the stuff that or basically sanitize the country's history. Mm-hmm. Miyazaki's very vocal on worldly issues. You know, there was the time when Spirited Away won an Oscar and he refused to attend the Academy Awards because he just disapproved of the U.S. involvement in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. So like, to me, it's like, he's a great filmmaker. He's an artist, but he really believes in the art that he makes by being vocal. And then you can kind of see how the movies that he makes relate to his opinion and his views and his values, right? So he kind of gives it a realistic sense of it. It's like, this is why I make the movies that I make, is because like the world is too modern. He's kind of against that whole pursuit of rapid technology and advancement. And he's a huge environmentalist. I'm excited. Apparently he's, Baldwin, I think you know this, I think he is working on a new film right now. I mean, I think he's come out of retirement twice.
Yeah.
That kind of man doesn't stay in retirement.
I know.
Yeah.
He's always said I'm going to retire after this film. Okay, I'm going to retire after this film. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then he's like, okay, I'm going to make another film. I'm looking it up now. He's working on a film called How Do You Live?
Interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's based off of a 1937 novel.
Oh, okay. So that'll be interesting. I mean, he's definitely not a sellout. He has that same sort of like streak in him that Bong Joon-ho and Park Chan-wook and Justin Chan, right? Where they're film directors and they're not playing with you. They literally made the film about this thing that they actually believe. So
yeah. And kind of people try to give them props and he's like, okay, middle finger, here you go.
He's like, did you even understand the film?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Baldwin, you're number one.
All right, my number one. My number one is Akira Kurosawa.
And, nice, classic.
This brings me back to my very first episode that I did with the podcast, Seven Samurai, he was the director of. But Akira Kurosawa is, he's from an older generation, so most people haven't seen his movies, but I really, really recommend you watch them if you're a film lover, specifically Seven Samurai, which we covered, but also Rashomon, Ron, and Kagemusha are all just insanely good movies. And really, I feel like they're masterclasses in filmmaking. He directed for over 50 years, and he's very well recognized in Hollywood, especially by big time directors like Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas. They all bring up Kurosawa all the time when they talk about their inspiration. And he was actually voted sixth best director of all time by Entertainment Weekly and Empire magazines. So his movies has been remade several times. The Magnificent Seven was remade after Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
A Fistful of Dollars was inspired by Yojimbo, and even Star Wars was inspired by The Hidden Fortress. A lot of people don't know that. But yeah, I mean, Kurosawa was really a trailblazer of his time. He was the first one who could really mix in the nuanced, patient style of Eastern films with the narrative themes and filmmaking techniques of the West. Especially cowboy movies. He was really influenced by John Ford. And then he's also able to layer in some like really tragic Shakespearean circumstances around the politics of war. And then he was also like influenced by writers like Dostoevsky and how they have really, really deep psychological elements in them too. But if I were to describe what makes him so good, is it's his ability to exercise complete control over the film and his vision. And I think that's like one of the biggest things he's known for. Like if he wants to show chaos and action, he uses quick cuts. He brings in the stormy weather. If he wants to show a character's emotional struggle, he like zooms in on their face really tight and stays there. So you could really be in their feelings with them. And Like, I know some of these things seem kind of redundant now. Like, everybody does this, right? But back then, these techniques were like very elusive, especially with action movies where you just have this wide angle and then you just point and shoot and let the actors do their thing. So overall, I feel like Kurosawa's dedication to his craft and his ability to create like really thrilling drama with stories that are layered with a lot of depth throughout his storied career is what makes him one of my favorite directors ever.
There's that rumor of his directing style, kind of directing with an iron fist.
Yeah, he was very, very intense.
I mean, very it's Japan. Intense. I think, yeah, like you could walk onto a set in Japan and say that about any director just because of the way that the hierarchies work there. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I'm sure he was special.
He used that to his advantage too. I talked about this, if you watch the, or if you listen to the Seven Samurai podcast, on that movie, like it was starting to go so much over budget that they told him to like just like cut a lot of stuff out. And what he did, he just took a vacation until they got funding again
for like Savage.
Yeah, he was just like, all right, well, I'm gonna just quit filming then.
And it's because, and I remember that, and you're talking about that Baldwin, it was because he knew that the studio had already invested so much into the movie.
Yeah,
he was like, if they kill the project, they're gonna waste so much money, so they have no choice but to find more funding and to complete the project. And it's like, damn.
Yeah, it feels like these movie directors have like a personality trait in common. I don't know how to describe it, but
very willful, very determined,
stubborn, or like, you know, just like something.
The personality trait of I don't give a fuck.
Exactly. That's the personality trait. Like, it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to say, you know, want to talk about how influential, I guess, or how widely recognizable Seven Samurai is I was watching the Kanye West documentary last night on Netflix, Genius. Have you guys seen it?
I've heard of it, but I haven't
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Really interesting, honestly. It's really interesting. Even if you're not necessarily a Kanye fan, it's just...
I'm a Kanye fan.
Yeah, I'm a Kanye fan too.
They're going to cancel us, Ray.
I like his music.
Just... there's a part in the documentary of him in more recent years when he like has this ranch in the middle of nowhere and he's recording tracks. And in the studio, there's like this huge wall of a screen that has a projector on it. And as they're like recording and doing music stuff, they're playing Seven Samurai on the screen.
Yeah.
Super random. I
that
was like,
much.
So cool.
Yeah.
I love when I see like little tidbits like that, like scattered throughout different parts of culture. Mm-hmm. You just find little moments where,
like real life Easter eggs.
Like, yeah,
exactly.
It's crazy. It's like Kanye's there, Justin Bieber's there, Rhymefest, all these like MCs and rappers and producers are there, and they have like Seven Samurai in the background.
Crazy.
That's kind of, that's what I want to do too, just have Seven Samurai constantly playing in the background.
Yeah. Okay, Prague, yeah.
Okay, well, I think my number one's obvious. It's Wong Kar-wai. I feel like I feel like I started a Wong Kar-wai revolution on the podcast because I kept pushing.
We've been doing a lot of Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah, it's okay. It's a phase. We're going through our Wong Kar-wai phase. You know, everyone has to have it. But I'm gonna, I guess, because we've talked about him to such length, I'll mention some different reasons why he's one of my favorite directors. And mostly it's because whenever you're watching a film, there's a sort of communication style to it, right? So some people are super straightforward, super linear. Some people will like just fuck linear and forget straightforward. And Wong Kar-wai is definitely more on that side of things.
Yes, definitely.
And I think that I really like that because if I was to make films and when I do write, it's very similar to my style as well. And so I really appreciate seeing someone else do that and do that to such a level of success. And I also like that he's able to like infuse such confusing storylines and films with so much meaning. And I like that everyone who comes into his work can sort of take something for themselves, and it doesn't have to be the same for, you know, all of the different people who come through. So I like that about his work. There's like a variability and like an ambiguity that lends itself to being like very, I think, open for a lot of different audiences.
Right. And interpretation.
Yes, basically open to interpretation.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I enjoyed all the lists. I learned a lot of the new directors, primarily from Pragya. Thank you all.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, I learned a new director today too.
Yeah. This is what it's all about. It's all about learning from each other. I did want to go just save some time for honorable mentions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Baldwin, I know you have some honorable mentions. And Pragya, if you have any, go ahead and share yours.
For sure. Honorable mentions for me, definitely Zhang Yimou. He made some of my favorite movies, Hero, House of Flying Daggers, Curse of the Golden Flower, and I think the last one is Raise the Red Lantern, which was actually one of the first movies he made. So definitely love him. And then James Wan, he's like becoming so big now. He used to be like a huge horror movie director. Like he made The Conjuring and like that whole universe.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite films.
But he also like expanded it to do action movies too. Like he did Furious 7. Aquaman. And he also started Saw, which is like so good too.
How many Saws are there now? They're 10?
Dude, there's at least six. Six I know for sure. And then they just redid one with Chris Rock in it too.
Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Shout out to Chris Rock.
You could mention him.
Chris Rock, hope you're doing well.
Yeah. The last honorable mention I have is Justin Lin. Simply because like he has made a lot of iconic movies. I know Better Luck Tomorrow is a little controversial within this group, but he made like all the Fast and Furious movies, like at least I think he made five of them. He made Star Trek Beyond. And I think he's like the highest grossing Asian American director ever. His movies have made over $2 billion in box office.
That's probably all from Fast and Furious
for sure.
But props to him though.
I know, props to him indeed. I do have some honorable mention as well. So one of them is Hirokazu Koreeda. I was going to put him on my list, but I felt like it would be a little bit strange to talk about him because he's a moody Japanese director. One of his really big films is Afterlife. It's an old film as well. And he really gets to like this like sensitive, like almost like very Japanese sense of understanding the human experience. So if you're ever feeling like I want to watch a Japanese film, Hirokazu Koreeda is a place to start. I also want to mention Makoto Shinkai, who we talked about a little bit because I had used one of his films on one of the other episodes. He is behind Your Name, Garden of Words, 5 centimeters per second. And so these are all animation films, super beautiful films. So if you ever want to know anything about like what's big in Japanese animation and what's influential, I think Makoto Shinkai's work is one of the most influential after someone like Hayao Miyazaki. So there's that. And I think that kind of concludes my honorable mentions.
I don't have too many honorable mentions too. I think the one person I wanted to put on the list but just didn't quite make it was Lulu Wang. Only because like The Farewell is another favorite film of mine. And it's really because I don't think Lulu Wang, she's only made 2 feature films and I've only seen The Farewell, so I just don't have that much of knowledge about her. But I'm confident that whatever future projects that she does, I mean, she's made short films, which I'm sure are very good as well, but I've just not seen too much of her work. I would like to, but hopefully she continues and will make more feature films in the future. So Lulu Wang is my honorable mention.
For sure. Can you guys add your honorable mentions to the run show, by the way? I want to check them out.
Okay.
Oh, definitely.
Will do. Okay. Well, that's going to conclude today's episode. I want to thank Pragya Baldwin for jumping on this pod again. Go check out the directors. Go check out the films we mentioned. Tune in next time for another episode of Real Asian Podcast.
Yeah, see you next time.
Peace.